Game on. Tennis.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Plenty to chat about. The Australian Open set to get underway. Stephen Higgins from crosscourtview.com is with me in studio. How are you?
Very good. Getting ready for my new sleep pattern.
Yeah, well, listen, good luck to you with that. If I see you now in a week or 10 days, I'll know how much tennis you've watched based on how caffeinated you are walking around the streets of Dublin.
A zombie wandering around.
But before we look into what's to come this year, let's be very honest. We were getting a tad nostalgic during the ad break about, like, you can talk about the new generation that's going to come and seize tennis going forward, or you can start lamenting the great names that have departed stage left.
Yeah, it's an interesting debate because you have to say people still hark back to the days of Borg and McEnroe. Mm. People still think about Sampras and Agassi. And even then, when you put these guys into perspective on the men's side, Djokovic has won nearly four times the amount of Grand Slams that John McEnroe did. Like, you know, like these three guys, plus Murray, who made a huge impact in the career and is a significant figure in that whole era. It's astonishing the level of success. It's so far beyond anything any could ever have imagined. And when you saw particularly, I think, Nadal and Djokovic are like these benchmarks of just quality and excellence for about 20 years where, you know, you imagine just a Grand Slam. Federer was always just this otherworldly beast. But Nadal was always at that level. Mm. If you wanted to win a Grand Slam, you met Nadal, you knew what level he was going to be at. You knew what Djokovic was going to be like. If you could beat those guys, this was...
It's funny in a way, we turn it into an almost like a WWF style rivalry. Like Hulk Hogan can't be friends with the Ultimate Warrior because, you know, and it's the same thing about like Djokovic and Murray working together at the moment is like, this can't happen. These two guys are too far in competition to each other. But listen, if you want to learn, if you want to be the best, you can learn from the best. And that's what Djokovic has done.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So they would have first met around 12 or so and they played in juniors and they played against each other their entire lives. A lot of pain in there, particularly in Australia where Murray lost four Australian Open finals to Djokovic, which he'll have to overcome. I think an interesting part of it is Murray was always a master tactician. He had a number of gifts, but that his brain was one of the peak ones. I think it's fascinating for someone like Djokovic that as much as Djokovic has achieved, and he's still trying to hang on. He's still trying to sneak out probably another Grand Slam to get to 25, see if he can stave off the young lads a bit longer. Is that maybe having the perspective of someone who faced him so much, it'd be interesting in the conversation where Murray would be like, I bet you didn't realise how good this thing you do is or how I was always worried about that. Maybe a fresh approach.
The other aspect as well is who has studied them more than the people who wanted to dislodge them at the top. It's, you know, I'm always fascinated by that angle of it as well.
Yeah, because people would often say when they wondered why was Nadal so dominant to Roland Garros, and then you'd ask players and they'd be kind of, you don't understand what it's like to face the ball that comes off the court from Nadal. It's unlike anything you've ever faced before. And so someone like Murray, who's so current, another thing as well, because of his age, because he's the same generation as Djokovic, he knows all these players. He's played all these people. They can talk at such a high level about what they're trying to do to break down these guys. It's going to be fascinating to see how he's going to manage trying to still challenge Sinner and Alcaraz, Zverev to try get that other Grand Slam.
Now, nostalgia to one side, and let's talk about what's going to happen over the coming weeks. I was suggesting to you during the ad break that 2024 was such a good tournament that it's going to be under pressure to build on for 2025. Like record attendance is coming of age for Jannik Sinner, complete dominance for Aryna Sabalenka. But you're taking me to task. You don't think last year was as vintage as I might be getting carried away with?
I think it was in many ways. It's great to see Sinner progress. Alcaraz still, particularly that run of Roland Garros to Wimbledon. His performance in the Wimbledon final against Djokovic is just one of the all-time great performances. To make Djokovic look, you'd dread to say ordinary, but to reduce him down to being uncompetitive in a Wimbledon final was quite astonishing. On the women's side, Aryna Sabalenka, the way that she has kind of turned around, a few years ago, she was chucking in underarm serves in Australia because her service motion had completely broken down. She'd lost all confidence in it. She had to go get a biomechanical expert to help her redo her serve. Now she is just a superstar beyond doubt on the hard courts in particular. She's almost unbeatable in hard courts. She's aiming for her third Australian Open in a row and she just won Brisbane going in. The question I would just have on the men's side particularly is, we have been spoilt for the last 20 years with these astonishing guys. And even beyond these three guys, you had people like Stan Wawrinka, Juan Martín Del Potro, really interesting figures, even Dominic Thiem for a few years. Dom McTeam is gone, Nadal is gone, Federer is gone, Murray's gone. We're left with the last vestiges of Djokovic. And my concern just at the top end of the game is, do we have the star power in people like Sinner and Zverev to carry that mantle?
So in a sporting context, is the question here, you look at, say, Alcaraz, for example, does he have the ability to compete and not allow it to be a procession for Sinner?
Alcaraz is... It almost seems like the whole weight of the sport on the men's side is on Alcaraz's shoulders because he has that X factor. Mm. He is just an incredible combination of the three main guys. As you saw at Wimbledon or Roland Garros, when he is at his top form, he reaches a level of athleticism and skill that we've rarely seen. Like, he is absolutely at that level, if not higher, than what the three guys were able to produce. The thing is, it is inconsistent. He kind of burned himself out probably by the end of last year because he'd had such a big summer with the two Grand Slams and the Olympic campaign. By the time it got to the US Open and then the ATP Finals, he was kind of running on fumes. Injuries have been an issue for him through his career. It'll be interesting to see as he goes forward and he tries to compete with the machine, basically. Sinner has almost taken that Djokovic mold of being like, I am going to play at 80 to 90% of my level pretty much 30 to 40 weeks a year. Can you compete with
that?
Which
takes the crack out of it for everyone else. And but even you look at Sinner, like, he has replicated last year's model in terms of not playing a warm-up event. Obviously, it worked from last year. He is hoping it works for him again this year. But, you know, let's be very honest. Like, there's a WADA shadow hanging over him. You know, it's probably disingenuous to refer to him as the pantomime villain of tennis at the minute. But, like, the future of the sport could rest an awful lot on how his career and life plays out maybe in the coming months.
It's an astonishing thing if you had the two cases very close to each other of these number one players in Jannik Sinner and Iga Świątek and these doping cases. Sinner's one is ongoing because, as people may know, while he did not receive a suspension because he was deemed to have not borne any negligent fault for this Clostobal. Clostobal is a steroid cream that his physio had used, gave him a few massages during March. He tested positive because of that, and that's what the case was about. However, WADA feel that he deserved some form of suspension as opposed to just being given no negligence or fault for it. So this now is being appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. For Sinner, it has massive repercussions. There is no date set for it. It looks like it might not be in the next month or so with appeals, but he could be banned for between a year and 2 years, depending on this. There's a great piece actually by Kevin Palmer about it, where he speaks to the head of the ITIA, which is the International Tennis Integrity Agency. They run those cases. And she was making the point of, because it was a steroid in a cream and you knew it was a steroid, even if he didn't know anything about it, he didn't ask for it, the physio was treating a cut on his finger. It is as kind of ridiculous as that. That because it was a product that you knew it had that in it, it's different case to, say, Simona Halep or Iga Świątek, where it was a contaminated product. And they can argue that I bought melatonin in the case of Iga Świątek, it was contaminated with this product and that's why I tested positive. That wasn't my intention. That's not what the product was for. There is this weird vagary there that because of, you know, Sinner didn't know he was getting this cream, didn't ask for his cream, etc. It was on a physio's finger. But still, the product was known to have this in it.
And listen, any of us who have had any dealings with people who are involved in anti-doping campaigning and anti-doping regulation will tell you that players are educated to within the nth degree of the personal responsibility and the need to educate oneself. So anyway, listen, we'll see how that plays out and we'll see how the men's side of the draw. From the women's, is it a penalty kick for Sabalenka when we look at just how her career has gone on hard court surfaces over the last couple of years?
Yeah, Sabalenka has kind of found this beautiful formula of the power was always there. The power has been there throughout her career. She was just a little bit inconsistent when she was younger, but she has allied that with more consistency. And actually, she moves a little bit better. She moves kind of maybe 5 or 10% better over the last few years, which leaves her to hang in rallies a little bit longer and where she can use her full force. I think the interesting story in that, Świątek is still struggling a little bit on hard courts to match her. She doesn't have the dominance that she has on clay. It's a different surface. She finds it hard to get her ball through the court in the same way and compete with the big hitters like Sabalenka or Rybakina. Coco Gauff's an interesting factor now, I think, because Coco Gauff was, of course, the US Open champion before, had a difficult season last year where she really struggled with different parts of her game, particularly her forehand. But she seems a little bit revitalized now, was excellent in the United Cup as the USA won. And it seems that she's actually had to, I think, change her grip on her forehand to try and make it a little bit more stable. She beat Świątek last week. It looked very stable. And we all know about her athleticism and all the other gifts in her game. So I think she's a really interesting factor in Australia. Sabalenka is the favourite, no question about it. But Goff should be in the mix there, judging by what we've seen so far.
Obviously, the caveat with all of this is we'll wake up tomorrow morning, hear Morning Ireland potentially, and know the draw in some way, shape or form. So that's the asterisk that's alongside all this in terms of us now trying to work out the brackets as the draw is made.
Yeah, I think it's... For some of these players, because the draw, because they're split, obviously, in the draws, Arina Sabalenka, he says here famously, he's not going to go out in the first two or three rounds. Now, that's not the level that she's
at
now.
We have that on tape now,
Steve. Yeah, exactly. Now, Swiatek has gone out in the third round and the second round the last two seasons, so she is vulnerable in Melbourne. She does not have the confidence going in that she has in other places. But I think it would be very hard to see by the level that they've been playing, you'd expect Arina Sabalenka in the women's and Jannik Sinner in the men's to be there at the business end in a fortnight.
Just to finish, like, your enthusiasm for this I always find compelling. And like, you love this. This is your life. And like, of the Grand Slams, of the big events, which one for you is the bucket list? If people say to themselves, I want to go and savour one of them.
My recommendation to everyone, I've said it loads of times, is because people would often go to Paris, do yourself a favour. If you're there during the tournament, just get a day pass. Take the significant other if there is, or just by yourself. Get a day pass to about 25, 30 euro tickets. Go down and just experience the vibrance, the colour, the noise. You'll never know. You'll never realise how passionate people are about a guy who's 76 in the world until you go to an outside court and hear them screaming. But the style of people, the different mix of cultures, the food... It's a fabulous experience just to go down, even for a few hours, just to see what that's like. Yeah. I'd always recommend Roland Garros.
Okay. Listen, I had the experience of it for both tennis and boxing during the summer. Two very different environments, two very different atmospheres. But, yeah, it's beautiful to walk around it and the parkland around it and everything else. So there we go. That's the bucket list for people. We've sport, travel and everything else sorted over the course of the last chat. Stephen, enjoy the next couple of weeks. Thanks so much for being with us. Stephen Higgins from Cross Court View.